The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. Today's program is generously underwritten by the White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. And from The Economist, first of January 27th, the Templeton Prize. A Muslim monarch and religious diplomat wins some overdue recognition. Jordanian religious diplomacy is more discreet than the Saudi kind, but may be more effective. One of the world's most lucrative prizes for spiritual endeavor, bequeathed by an American-British billionaire who was a fervent Christian, has been awarded this year to one of the luminaries of the Muslim world, King Abdullah of Jordan. The Jordanian monarch, whose dynasty claims descent from the Prophet Muhammad, is only the second Muslim to receive the Templeton Prize, worth £1.1 million, or about $1.5 million, since it was instituted in 1973. Its stated aim is to honor, every year, an individual who has made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. The prize, and the Templeton Foundation which administers it, were established by Sir John Templeton, an American-born investor who was a devoted Presbyterian Christian but also saw value in learning about other religions. Previous recipients have included South Africa's Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lord Jonathan Sacks, former Chief Rabbi of Britain and the Commonwealth, and Charles Colson, a member of Richard Nixon's White House who went to jail for obstructing justice and then became a prison evangelist. By honoring the Jordanian sovereign, the prize givers are sending quite a subtle message about the value of patient diplomacy rooted in strong scholarly work. King Abdullah and his Hashemite dynasty have been responsible for some impressive initiatives aimed at curbing extremism within Islam and at easing tensions between the leading monotheistic faiths. In one of these initiatives, known as the Amman Declaration, eminent figures from eight different legal schools, representing virtually all the strains of Islam, came together. They affirmed that despite sectarian differences, they would recognize each other as valid Muslims and hold back from branding each other with proclamations of takfir, in other words, allegations of apostasy. That might sound trivial, but it isn't. One of the hallmarks of murderously extreme jihadists is that they are quick to describe Muslims less fanatical than themselves as apostates or deviants from the faith. That is only a small step from calling them worthy of death. Another trademark of modern jihadis is that they claim the right to proclaim fatwas or judgments on religious matters, regardless of whether they have any training in theology. So, signatories of the so-called Amman Declaration, whose numbers have steadily increased across at least 50 countries, specified that only qualified authorities could issue fatwas. Another big initiative by the Jordanian Royal House was the Common Word, in which distinguished Muslims issued a friendly challenge to bigwigs of the Christian world, inviting them to dialogue and cooperation on the basis of two axioms which, in the signatories' view, were present in both religions: love of God and love of neighbor. In recent times, religious diplomacy by much wealthier rulers of Saudi Arabia has enjoyed more publicity than the highbrow work sponsored by the Jordanian royals. In part, this reflects a shift in the Arab world's center of gravity, away from the troubled Levant and toward the wealthy Gulf. But the newly announced prize is a reminder that in a faith which values continuity in tradition, there is no substitute for diligent scholarly work. In the words of H.A. Hellyer, an analyst of Islam with RUSI, a London think tank, and the Atlantic Council based in Washington, D.C., this news about the award is very significant because of what the prize was awarded for: interfaith work between Christians and Muslims, initiated by Muslims, and an interfaith work among Muslims, initiated by Sunni Muslims. For all the recent media frenzy over Saudi Arabia's claimed shift to the mainstream of Sunni Islam, it is difficult to imagine any such prize being awarded to Riyadh's rulers for this kind of work. And from the Associated Press now of June 30th, evangelical leaders downplay the potential Roe v. Wade reversal. For evangelical Christian leaders like Jerry Falwell Jr., this is their political holy grail. Like many religious conservatives in a position to know, the Liberty University president with close ties to the White House suspects that the Supreme Court vacancy President Donald Trump fills in the coming months will ultimately lead to the reversal of the landmark abortion case Roe v. Wade. But instead of celebrating publicly, some evangelical leaders are downplaying their fortune on an issue that has defined their movement for decades. What people don't understand is if you overturn Roe v. Wade, all that does is give the states the right to decide whether abortion is legal or illegal in their state, Falwell told the Associated Press in an interview. My guess is that there'd probably be fewer than 20 states that would make abortion illegal if given that right. Falwell added, in the 70s, I don't know how many states had abortion illegal before Roe v. Wade, but it wouldn't be near as many this time. The sentiment, echoed by evangelical leaders across the country this past week, underscores the delicate politics that surround a moment many religious conservatives have longed for. With the retirement of swing vote Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, Trump and his Republican allies in the Senate plan to install a conservative justice who could redefine the law of the land on some of the nation's most explosive policy debates, and none bigger than abortion. And while these are the very best of times for the religious right, social conservatives risk a powerful backlash from their opponents if they cheer too loudly. Women's groups have already raised the alarm for their constituents, particularly suburban women, who are poised to play an outsized role in the fight for the House majority this November. 2/3 of Americans do not want to see Roe v. Wade overturned, according to a poll released Friday by the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation. Among women of reproductive age, 3 out of 4 want the high court ruling left alone. The poll was conducted before Kennedy's retirement was announced. The left is going to try very hard to say this is all about overturning Roe, said Johnny Moore, a Southern Baptist minister who is co-chairman of the Trump campaign's Evangelical Advisory Board. The more significant shift in the high court, he said, would likely be the help given to conservatives in their fight for what they call religious freedom. Tony Perkins, who leads the Socially Conservative Family Research Council, said abortion was simply a factor in evangelicals' excitement over the more conservative Supreme Court. He suggested that public opinion was already shifting against abortion rights, although that's not true of the Roe v. Wade ruling, which has become slightly more popular over time. Perkins agreed with Moore that the broader push for religious freedom was a bigger conservative focus. Many evangelicals, for example, have lashed out against Obama-era laws that required churches and other religious institutions to provide their employees with women's reproductive services, including access to abortion and birth control. Others have rallied behind private business owners who face legal repercussions after denying services to gay people. Yet, sweeping restrictions to abortion rights are certainly on the table, Moore noted. There is a high level of confidence within the community that overturning Roe is actually finally possible, Moore said. He added, evangelicals have never been more confident in the future of America than they are now. It's just a fact. In Alabama, Tom Parker, a Republican associate justice on the state Supreme Court who was campaigning to become the state's chief justice, explicitly raised the potential of sending cases to Washington that would lead to the overturning of key rulings, including Roe v. Wade. President Trump is just one appointment away from giving us a conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, Parker said in an interview on the radio program Wall Builders Live. And they are going to need cases that they can use to reverse these horrible decisions of the liberal majority in the past that have undermined the Constitution and really just abused our own personal rights. Despite Trump's struggles with Christian values in his personal life at times, skeptical evangelical Christians lined up behind him in the 2016 election, and they remain one of his most loyal constituencies. The president's standing with white evangelical Christians hit an all-time high in April when 75% of evangelicals held a favorable view of Trump, according to a poll conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute. The unlikely marriage between the thrice-married president and Christian conservatives has always been focused on Trump's ability to reshape the nation's judicial branch. On the day she endorsed candidate Trump in March 2016, the late iconic anti-abortion activist Phyllis Schlafly first asked him privately whether he would appoint more judges like the conservative Antonin Scalia. Recalled Schlafly's successor Ed Martin, who was in the room at the time, Trump promised he would. The president followed through with the appointment of Neil Gorsuch less than a month after his inauguration, delighting religious conservatives nationwide. And the Trump White House, while disorganized in other areas, made its relationship with the religious right a priority. The first private White House meeting between evangelical leaders and senior Trump officials came in the days after the Gorsuch nomination, said Moore, who was in attendance. He said the White House has hosted roughly two dozen similar meetings since then in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building adjacent to the White House. A senior administration official such as Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, or Kellyanne Conway, if not Trump himself, has always been present, Moore added. Each meeting featured a detailed briefing on the administration's push to fill judicial openings. The courts have been at the very center of the relationship, Moore said. Now, as the focus shifts toward the president's next Supreme Court nomination, evangelical leaders who once held their noses and voted for Trump have little doubt he will pick someone who shares their conservative views on abortion, same-sex marriage, and other social issues. Falwell insisted only that Trump make his next selection from the list of prospective nominees he released before his election. All are believed to oppose the Roe v. Wade ruling. Any deviation from the list, Falwell said, would be a betrayal. He noted, however, that he is in weekly contact with the White House and has supreme confidence that the president will deliver. This is a vindication for the 80% of evangelicals who supported Trump. Many of them voted on this issue alone, Falwell said. Today's a day that we as evangelicals, and really all average Americans, can say we told you so. And from the Religion News Service now of June 29th, multiracial churches increase as blacks and whites learn to worship together. For 2.5 years, Jamel Armstrong and Matt Ness have jointly led One Church, capital O, capital C, a congregation striving to be diverse in a neighborhood in Louisville, Kentucky that is most interracial, more interracial than most. It's a work in progress, they acknowledge, but the African-American and white co-pastors say they believe their congregation, which is close to 50% black and 50% white, is more fulfilling than the more racially segregated churches they used to lead. On our own, we just didn't feel like that's who we were meant to be, said Ness, who formerly led a mostly white church. The picture we believed in was much broader than the local church I was pastoring and the local church Jamel was pastoring. The co-pastor's congregation is part of the Evangelical Covenant Church, a small denomination that claims to be one of the most diverse in the country. One Church is part of a trend reported by scholars this month. Multiracial churches are on the rise, and so is the percentage of U.S. congregants who attend them. The percentage of U.S. multiracial congregations almost doubled between 1998 and 2012, from 6.4% to 12%, according to a study released in June in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. In the same period, the percentage of U.S. congregants attending an interracial church have reached almost 1 in 5, advancing from 12.7% to 18.3%. The 2012 statistics are the latest available. Co-authors Kevin Doherty, a sociology professor at Baylor University, and Michael Emerson, provost at North Park University, defined multiracial congregations as one in which no single racial or ethnic group constitutes more than 80% of the people in the pews. But the co-authors point out that interracial congregations have long faced a number of challenges, and their recent findings show that while the average percentage of black congregants in multiracial congregations has increased, the percentage of Latinos in those kinds of churches has decreased in the same period. When you bring groups, different ethnic groups, together in a congregation, they come with different cultures, and those cultures include all types of expectations, said Doherty, citing music styles and food choices. To help them develop a sense of shared identity above and beyond those cultural differences is a key part of the adaptability necessary for a multiracial congregation to succeed. Ness, co-pastor of the Louisville Church, alternates preaching with Armstrong. He said before One Church opened its doors, they formulated a non-traditional approach to music. The worship team includes a gospel-style keyboardist, a blues, rock, and country guitarist, and a jazzy drummer and bassist, and singers represent a range of genres. We didn't want to be defined by a particular style, and so we didn't tell you to stand up. We didn't tell you to lift your hands. We didn't tell you how to worship, said Armstrong. The goal was, if you are naturally contemplative in your worship style, then you be that. If you are naturally expressive, then you be that. It didn't work for everyone. Armstrong said there was a gradual mass exodus from the 250 attendee first service in January 2016, with the congregation dropping to about 50, and the congregation has since doubled to 100 after attracting new congregants. The Reverend Michael Davis, an African-American teaching pastor at 10-year-old Downtown Church in Memphis, Tennessee, said intentionality is the key to multiracial churches. His congregation strives to have leaders of different races regularly preaching and making announcements. The church avoids identifying with political parties and instead seeks to foster an environment where various viewpoints can be aired. So nobody is trying to suffocate the identity of any of our minorities, said Davis, who co-leads the fledgling congregation with its white founder, Richard Reeves. It's intentionality, it's empowerment, and it's sacrifice. The congregation, which Davis calls a multiracial, multi-class plant, or offshoot of the mostly white Second Presbyterian Church, meets in Claiborne Temple, a historic church that once housed a predominantly white congregation and later a mostly black one. Davis acknowledges that his Evangelical Presbyterian Church congregation, that is 70% white and 30% minority, mostly black but including some Asians and Latinos, hasn't achieved all its milestones toward integration, including among its smaller community groups attended by some of the 300 who worship together on Sunday. Are we doing it perfectly? Davis said, no. Because there are some times when I have to talk to some of my groups that are predominantly white and say, how do we get more diversity? As they strive for inclusiveness, leaders of multiracial churches say they sometimes feel they are on their own without many role models. Ness, age 39, who's pastored for 16 years, said, I feel like I'm brand new at my job when I started this. Armstrong, 38, agreed that the non-traditional church stands out from others. We almost feel a lot of times that we're on an island. The Reverend Susan Brooks Thistlewaite, a Chicago Theological Seminary professor, informally polled former students and found that they have seen evidence of the new survey's findings about the growth of interracial congregations. One woman graduate who identified as white indicated that she had pastored a black church for several years, said Thistlewaite, whose seminary is affiliated with the United Church of Christ. A number of graduates emphasized, however, that there have been congregations that have been racially diverse for many years with racially diverse pastoral leadership. The survey, based on data from the National Congregations Study, also found an increase in black clergy leading multiracial congregations, rising from less than 5% in both 1998 and 2006 to 17% in 2012. The Reverend Cheryl Townsend Sykes, professor of African American Studies and Sociology at Colby College, said the willingness of white congregants to join churches with black pastors is a positive sign, given the long history of segregated Sunday morning services. Although white people have always been willing to appropriate style and music from black churches, they have resisted black leadership. This moment in religious life in America could be quite helpful in countering many negative current events in the area of race relations. Despite the challenges of interracial cooperation, Davis said, he sees rewards as he helps lead his Memphis congregation. I experience the body of Christ more, the wider scope of it, and so it broadens my perspective of who the Lord is, he said. Being in a multiracial church, you see the beauty of different cultural backgrounds, different walks of life. And from the Guardian now of June 28th, an international footballer and a model who won the right to have a lawful humanist wedding in Northern Ireland have failed to secure a judicial declaration for a wider law change after judges said existing legislation meant it was not needed. The appeal court judges in the case of the model Laura Lacolle and the Leeds United and Republic of Ireland footballer Eunan O'Kane ruled against a wider law change on humanist marriages but said existing laws already avoided discrimination. The three judges found the current law enables couples to apply for temporary authorization for a humanist celebrant to conduct marriages. For this reason, the court in Belfast said the definition of legal marriages did not need to be expanded to incorporate specific beliefs such as humanism. Despite losing the substantive case, LaCole welcomed the finding as a, quote, step forward, insisting a precedent had been set for couples to have legally recognized humanist weddings in the region. The couple originally went to court because they were refused temporary authorization from Northern Ireland's General Register Office, GRO, when they applied. They won the right to have their ceremony legally recognized. In the couple's original High Court victory last year, the trial judge had ruled that the law should be altered to include the term, quote, or beliefs among definitions of religious ceremonies. In appeal by Northern Ireland's Attorney General John Larkin, Stormont's Department of Finance and the GRO, was allowed by the appeal court judges on Thursday. The granting of that authorization was not appealed against. Humanism is a non-religious belief system that rejects the concepts of a higher deity or afterlife, believing humans steer their own destiny. Humanist marriages are already legally recognized in Scotland, but not in England or Wales. They are also recognized in the Republic of Ireland. LaCole said that while the law would not be changed, the consequences of the appeal court ruling meant couples now had a clear pathway to have lawful humanist ceremonies. I'm really happy, she said, outside the Court of Appeal in Belfast. The fact that we are now walking away having a door be open for the non-religious in Northern Ireland to have a humanist ceremony befitting their beliefs is amazing. So other people can ultimately have the wedding we had, and that was the goal. So we're really happy. The couple's lawyer, Kieran Moynagh, also drew positives from the judgment. Essentially, it does open the door today that humanist ceremonies will be recognized in Northern Ireland, he said. The initial ask was that belief was read into the legislation or the legislation was declared incompatible, and that would have made the government seriously consider the marriage law and look at rewriting it or changing provisions in it. Today, we did not get that declaration of incompatibility or read-in. We got an alternative saying there is a solution on the already existing law, and you should use that. The lawyer added that it would now be difficult for the GRO to reject future applications for temporary authorization, given what the judges had said. If the government decided to give a blanket no on the temporary authorization, then this matter could have quickly come back into court, he said. Andrew Copson, chief executive of Humanists UK, said, "We are delighted at the outcome of this hearing, which will enable thousands of couples to get married in a way that is personal and meaningful to them. Laura and Yunan have fought bravely for what is simply a matter of fairness, and their efforts in succeeding must be highly commended. As for England and Wales, now is the time for action. They are isolated as the only parts of Britain and Ireland where humanist marriage is not recognized." Humanists UK has again written to the British government, calling on it to make arrangements for legal representation and recognition as soon as possible. And from the New York Times now, of June 29th, a contribution by Stephen Petro, a Hillsboro, North Carolina writer, for the column Well. Do you believe in magic? I do. Talismans and amulets, objects believed to have magical powers, were once part of any self-respecting doctor's medicine bag. If a fairy god bunny comes into your life, embrace it. The velvety rabbit with big floppy ears and a silver tiara came to me 34 years ago with a name tag that read Fairy God Bunny. That was when I was in my mid-20s and had cancer. For 5 years, I carried this rabbit with me to the hospital for labs, CT scans, and x-rays. I was never shy about introducing it to anyone, nor did I feel hypocritical, even though I was a 26-year-old PhD candidate. My friend Cynthia had given me the bunny soon after my testicular cancer diagnosis, reminding me several times that it had magical powers. She later boosted those powers by adding a wand trimmed in gold lamé to complement its frilly tutu. That bunny was intended to be my talisman, a magical defender against my cancer. You'd expect me to be skeptical. I'd grown up in an age of science when facts and data reigned supreme. I'd excelled at Manhattan-Stuyvesant High School, famous for its geek curriculum. As a three-time visitor to the nearby 1964 World's Fair, a paean to new technology, I had drunk DuPont's Kool-Aid, better living through chemistry. When I first got sick, I read every evidence-based, peer-reviewed study I could get my hands on so that I could make the best informed treatment decisions. My odds of survival were actually pretty decent, but I found that data wasn't enough. As a 20-something, I simply couldn't accept any chance of not making it to 30. Put simply, science could not guarantee me a 100% successful outcome. Enter the bunny. I needed another tool in my tool belt to improve my chances. And I was not alone. Stuart Weiss, a psychologist and author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, told me that many people turn to irrational beliefs in times of dire need. Whenever medical science does not provide a cure, there is going to be a psychological gap, a need for something better, he said. Enter superstition, magic, paranormal beliefs, and religion. It's not uncommon to be of two minds and to say, I know this is crazy, but I'll feel better if I do it anyway, Dr. Weiss said. Indeed, I never abandoned conventional medicine. I followed my oncologist's orders, 3 surgeries, 4 rounds of chemo, years of anxiety-ridden follow-ups, but I would not leave my fate in the doctor's hands alone. The fairy god bunny would be my amulet. Before knowledge overshadowed faith, talismans and amulets, objects to believe medical powers, were in any doctor's medicine bag. Their documented use dates back at least to the medieval period when they were in addition to, not a replacement for, surgery. And the use of medical talismans has persisted. Dr. Willem Bartholomew, the pediatrician and bioethicist at Kansas University Medical Center, wrote prolifically about his struggle with metastatic esophageal cancer and his collection of 40 frogs. Bill's frogs were totems or talismans that he believed brought him luck, said Martha Montello, his friend and a lecturer at the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Montello pointed out that he lived, quote, an amazing 5 years after diagnosis, much longer than his doctors predicted. I believe in that kind of magic. Do I sound like a kook? I don't think so, but no kook ever does. Dr. Ted Kapchuk, a Harvard physician, told the New Yorker writer several years ago that he always believed, quote, there is an important component of medicine that involves suggestion, ritual, and belief, he said. All ideas that make scientists scream. Dr. Kapchuk is the chief of Harvard's program in placebo studies and the therapeutic encounter, which is focused on studying the power of the mind to influence health outcomes. In that same interview, he noted that medicine had known for centuries that some people respond to the power of suggestion, but don't know why or how. During his tenure at Harvard, Dr. Kapchuk wrote in an email, I haven't been twiddling my thumbs. He sent along a list of more than a dozen studies he's either led or participated in that show how placebos, rituals, beliefs, and talismans play a role, albeit modest, when compared with surgery and medication. When you're in a fight for your life, modest is something to hang on to. 5 years after my diagnosis, my oncologist said I was cured. I believe science played a key role in that, but I also think the hope embodied in a bunny made a difference in my well-being, reducing anxiety, giving me more good days than bad. Can I prove it? No. Does that mean it's not true? No. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for tuning in. This has been brought to you by the White Memorial Presbyterian Church, 919-834-3424. Michael Blakely, I'll talk to you later.